communal cook fires to share the evening meal. Everyone sitting on stone or wooden benches, relaxing and chatting. But there's a big knot of people seated around Inan where he's been regaling them with something. He switches to Sansamet at once, however, since he's one of the few people in the comm who can speak it, albeit with a heavy accent.
I have been waiting for you both. We saved good stories for you, here.
He actually rises and beckons to them, as if yelling at the top of his lungs wasn't enough to get their attention. And as if a 6.5-foot-tall man with a huge mane of braids and clothes from 3 different nations, all of it garish, would be hard to spot amid the crowd. Yet Cyanite finds herself smiling as she steps into the ring of benches where Inan has, apparently, kept one open just for them. Other members of the comm murmur greetings, which Cyan is beginning to recognize. Out of politeness, she attempts to stammer something similar back, and endures their chuckles when she gets it wrong. Inan grins at her, and repeats the phrase properly. She tries again and sees nods all around.
Excellent, Inan says,
so emphatically that she cannot help but believe him. Then he grins at Alabaster beside her.
You're a good teacher, I think.
Alabaster ducks his head a little. Not really. I can't seem to stop my pupils from hating me. Inan's voice is low and deep, and reverberates like the deepest of shakes. When he smiles, it's like the surface breach of a vesicle, something bright and hot and alarming, especially up close.
We must see if we can change that,
And he looks at Cyan, unabashed in his interest, and plainly not caring when the other members of the comm chuckle. That's the problem, see? This ridiculous, loud, vulgar man has made no secret of the fact that he wants Cyanite. And unfortunately, because otherwise this would be easy, there's something about him that Cyan actually finds herself attracted to. His ferality, perhaps. She's never met anyone like him. Thing is, he seems to want Alabaster, too. And Alabaster doesn't seem disinterested, either. It's a little confusing. Once he has successfully flustered both of them, Inan turns his infinite charm on his people.
Well, here we are, with food aplenty, and fine new things that other people have made and paid for.
He shifts into Eterpic then, repeating the words for everyone. They chuckle at the last part, largely because many of them have been wearing new clothes and jewelry and the like since the ship came. Then Inan continues, and Cyan doesn't really need Alabaster to explain that Inan is telling everyone a story, because Inan does this with his whole body. He leans forward and speaks more softly, and everyone is riveted to whatever tense moment he is describing. Then he pantomimes someone falling off something and makes the sound of a splat by cupping his hands and squeezing air from between his palms. The small children who are listening practically fall over laughing, while the older kids snicker and the adults smile. Alabaster translates a little of it for her. Apparently, Inan is telling everyone about their most recent raid on a small coaster comm, some 10 days sailing to the north. Cyan's only half listening to Baster's summation, mostly paying attention to the movements of Inan's body and imagining him performing entirely different movements, when suddenly, Alabaster stops translating. When she finally notices this, surprised, he's looking at her, intently.
Do you want him?
He asks her. Cyan grimaces, mostly out of embarrassment. He's spoken softly, but they're right next to Inan, and if he suddenly decides to pay attention... Well, what if he does? Maybe it would make things easier to get it all out into the open. She would really prefer to have a choice about that, though. And as usual, Alabaster is not giving her one. You don't have a subtle bone in your body, do you?
No, I don't.
Tell me. What, then? Is this some kind of challenge? Because she's seen the way Alabaster looks at Inan. It's mostly cute, watching the 40-year-old man blush and stammer like a virgin. Want me to back off? Alabaster flinches and looks almost hurt. Then he frowns as if confused by his own reaction, which makes two of them, and draws away a little. His mouth pulls to one side as he murmurs, "If I said yes, would you? Would you really?" Cyanite blinks. Well, she did suggest it. But would she? All of a sudden, she doesn't know. When she fails to respond, though, Alabaster's expression twists in frustration. He mumbles something that might be never mind, then gets up and steps out of the story circle, taking care not to disturb anyone else as he goes. It means Cyanite loses the ability to follow the tale, but that's all right. Inan is a joy to watch, even without words. And since she doesn't have to pay attention to the story, she can consider Alabaster's question. After a while, the tale ends, and everyone claps. Almost immediately, there are calls for another story. In the general mill, as people get up for second helpings from the massive pot of spiced shrimp, rice, and smoked sea bubble that is tonight's meal, Cyanite decides to go find Alabaster. She's not sure what she's going to say, but, well, he deserves some kind of answer. She finds him in their house, where he's curled up in a corner of the big empty room, a few feet from the bed of dried seagrass and cured animal furs they've been sleeping on. He hasn't bothered to light the lanterns. She makes him out as a darker blot against the shadows. "Go away," he snaps when she steps into the room. "I live here too," she snaps back. "Go somewhere else if you want to cry or whatever you're doing." Earth. She hopes he's not crying. He sighs. It doesn't sound like he's crying, although he's got his legs drawn up and his elbows propped on his knees and his head's half buried in his hands. He could be. "Cyan, you're such a steelheart." "So are you, when you want to be." "I don't want to be. Not always." "Rust, Cyan. Don't you ever get tired of it all?" He stirs a little. Her eyes have adjusted, and she sees that he's looking at her. "Don't you ever just want to be human?" She comes into the house and leans against the wall next to the door, crossing her arms and her ankles. "We aren't human."
"Yes, we are."
His voice turns fierce.
"I don't give a shit what the something-somethingeth Council of Big Important Farts decreed, or how the geomests classify things, or any of that. That we're not human is just the lie they tell themselves so they don't have to feel bad about how they treat us."
This, too, is something all Ragas know. Only Alabaster is vulgar enough to say it aloud. Cyanite sighs and leans her head back against the wall. "If you want him, you idiot, just tell him so. You can have him." And just like that, his question is answered. Alabaster falls silent in mid-rant, staring at her.
"You want him too?"
"Yeah."
It costs her nothing to say this.
"But I'm okay if..." She shrugs a little.
"Yeah."
Alabaster takes a deep breath. Then another, then a third. She has no idea what any of those breaths means.
"I should make the same offer you just did," he says at last. "Do the noble thing, or at least pretend to. But I..."
In the shadows, he hunches more, tightening his arms round his knees. When he speaks again, his voice is barely audible.
"It's just been so long, Cyan."
Not since he's had a lover, of course. Just since he's had a lover he wanted. There's laughter from the center of the gathering cavern, and now people are moving along the corridors, chattering and breaking up for the night. They can both hear Inan's big voice rumbling not far off. Even when he's just having a normal conversation, practically everyone can hear him. She hopes he's not a shouter in bed. Sion takes a deep breath. Want me to go get him? And just to be clear, she adds, for you. Alabaster is silent for a long moment. She can feel him staring at her, and there's a kind of emotional pressure in the room that she can't quite interpret. Maybe he's insulted. Maybe he's touched. Rust if she'll ever be able to figure him out. And rust if she knows why she's doing this. Then he nods, rubs a hand over his hair, and lowers his head. Thank you. The words are almost cold. But she knows that tone because she's used it herself. Anytime she's needed to hold on to her dignity, with fingernails and pent breath. So she leaves and follows that rumble, eventually finding Inan near the communal cook fire in deep conversation with Harless. Everyone else has dissipated by now, and the cavern echoes in a steady, overlapping drone of fussy toddlers fighting sleep, laughter, talking, and the hollow creaking of the boats in the harbor outside as they rock in their moorings. And over all of it, the hiss-purr of the sea. Cyanite settles herself against a wall nearby, listening to all these exotic sounds and waiting. After perhaps 10 minutes, Inan finishes his conversation and rises. Harless heads away, chuckling over something Inan said, ever the charmer. As Cyan expected, Inan then comes over to lean against the wall beside her.
My crew think I'm a fool to pursue you, he says casually, gazing up at the vaulted ceiling as if there's something interesting up there. They think you don't like me.
Everyone thinks I don't like them, Cyanite says. Most of the time it's true.
I do like you.
He looks at her, thoughtful, which she likes. Flirting unnerves her. Much better to be straightforward like this.
I have met your kind before, he says. The ones taken to the fulcrum.
His accent mangles this into fulcrum, which she finds especially fitting.
You are the happiest one I've seen.
Cyanite snorts at the joke, and then, seeing the wry twist to his lips, the heavy compassion in his gaze, she realizes he's not joking at all. Oh. Alabaster's pretty happy.
No, he isn't.
No, he isn't. But this is why Cyanite doesn't like jokes much, either. She sighs. I'm here for him, actually.
Oh, so you have decided to share?
He's... She blinks as the words register. Inan shrugs, which is an impassive gesture, given how big he is, and how it sets all his braids a-rustle.
You and he are already lovers. It was a thought.
What a thought. No. I don't, no. There are things she's not ready to think about. Maybe later. A lot later. He laughs, though not at her.
Yes, yes. You have come, then, what? To ask me to see to your friend?
He's not... But here she is, procuring him a lover for the night.
Rust.
Inan laughs, softly for him, and shifts to lean sideways against the wall, perpendicular to Cyanite, so that she will not feel boxed in, even though he's close enough that she can feel his body heat. Something big men do if they want to be considerate, rather than intimidating. She appreciates his thoughtfulness, and she hates herself for deciding in Alabaster's favor because earth fires.
He even smells sexy as he says, You are a very good friend, I think.
Yes. I rusting am.
She rubs her eyes.
No, no. Everyone sees that you are the stronger of the pair.
Sinite blinks at this, but he's completely serious. He lifts a hand and draws a finger down the side of her face from temple to chin, a slow tease.
Many things have broken him. He holds himself together with spit and endless smiling. But all can see the cracks. You, though, you are dented, bruised, but intact. It is kind of you, looking out for him like so.
No one ever looks out for me. Then she shuts her mouth so hard that her teeth snap. She hadn't meant to say that. Inan smiles, but it is a gentle, kindly thing.
I will,
he says, and leans down to kiss her. It is a scratchy sort of kiss. His lips are dry, his chin beginning to hair over. Most coaster men don't seem to grow beards, but Inan might have some Sansa in him, especially with all that hair. In any case, his kiss is so soft, despite the scratchiness, that it feels more like a thank you than an attempt to seduce. Probably because that's what he intends.
Later. I promise I will.
Then he leaves, heading for the house she shares with Alabaster. And Sinite gazes after him and thinks, belatedly, now where the rust am I supposed to sleep tonight? It turns out to be a moot question, because she's not sleepy. She goes to the ledge outside the cavern, where there are others lingering to take in the night air, or talk where half the calm can't hear them. And she is not the only one standing wistfully at the railing, looking out over the water at night. The waves roll in steadily, making the smaller boats and the Klausu rock and groan, and the starlight casts thin, diffuse reflections upon the waves that seem to stretch away into forever. It's peaceful here in Maeve. It's nice to be who she is in a place that accepts her. Nicer still, to know that she has nothing to fear for it. A woman Sinite met in the baths, one of the Klausu crew, most of whom speak at least a little Sansamot, explained it to her as they sat soaking in water warmed by rocks the children heat in the fire as part of their daily chores. It's simple, really.
With you, we live,
she'd said to Sion, shrugging and letting her head fall back against the edge of the bath, and apparently not caring about the strangeness in her own words. On the mainland, everyone is convinced that with Ragas nearby, they will all die. And then the woman said something that truly unnerved Sion.
Harlas is old. Inan sees much danger on raids. You and the Laughing One.
That is the locals' term for Alabaster, since the ones who don't speak Sansamot have trouble pronouncing his name.
You have babies? Give us one, yes? Or we have to go steal from the mainland.
The very idea of these people who stick out like stone eaters in a crowd trying to infiltrate the fulcrum to kidnap a grit, or grabbing some feral child just ahead of the guardians makes Sinite shiver. She's not sure she likes the idea of them greedily hoping she catches pregnant, either. But they're no different from the fulcrum in that, are they? And here, any child that she and Alabaster have won't end up in a node station. She lingers out on the ledge for a few hours, losing herself in the sound of the waves, and gradually letting herself lapse into a kind of not-thinking fugue. Then she finally notices that her back is aching and her feet hurt, and the wind off the water is getting chilly. She can't just stand out here all night. So she heads back into the cavern, not really sure where she means to go, just letting her feet carry her where they will. Which is probably why she eventually ends up back outside her house, standing in front of the curtain that passes for privacy,
and listening to Alabaster weep through it. It's definitely him. She knows that voice, even though it's choked now with sobs and half-muffled. Barely audible, really, despite the lack of doors and windows. But she knows the why of that, doesn't she? Everyone who grows up in the fulcrum learns to cry very, very quietly. It is this thought, and the sense of camaraderie that follows it, that makes her reach up slowly and tug the curtain aside. They're on the mattress, thankfully half covered in furs, not that it matters, since she can see clothing discarded about the room, and the air smells of sex, so it's obvious what they've been up to. Alabaster's curled up on his side, his back to her, bony shoulders shaking. Inan sitting up on one elbow, stroking his hair. His eyes flick up when Cyanide opens the curtain, but he doesn't seem upset or surprised. In fact, and in light of their previous conversation, she really shouldn't be surprised, but she is. He lifts a hand, beckoning. She's not sure why she obeys, and she's not sure why she undresses as she walks across the room, or why she lifts up the furs behind Alabaster and slides into the redolent warmth with him. Or why, once she's done this, she curves herself against his back and drapes an arm over his waist and looks up to see Inan's sad smile of welcome. But she does. Sign falls asleep like this. As far as she can tell, Alabaster cries for the rest of the night, and Inan stays up to comfort him the whole time. So when she wakes the next morning and claws her way out of bed and stumbles over to the chamber pot to throw up noisily into it, they both sleep through it. There is no one to comfort her, as she sits there shaking in the aftermath. But that is nothing new. Well, at least the people of Maeve won't have to go steal a baby now.
Put no price on flesh.
From Tablet 1, on Survival, Verse 6. Interlude. There passes a time of happiness in your life, which I will not describe to you. It is unimportant. Perhaps you think it wrong that I dwell so much on the horrors, the pain. But pain is what shapes us, after all. We are creatures born of heat and pressure and grinding, ceaseless movement. To be still is to be not alive. But what is important is that you know it was not all terrible. There was peace in long stretches between each crisis, a chance to cool and solidify before the grind resumed. Here is what you need to understand. In any war, there are factions, those wanting peace, those wanting more war for a myriad of reasons, and those whose desires transcend either. And this is a war with many sides, not just two. Did you think it was just the Stills and the Origins? No, no. Remember the Stone Eaters and the Guardians, too. Oh! And the seasons. Never forget Father Earth. He has not forgotten you. So while you rested, those are the forces that gathered round. Eventually they began their advance. 20. Cyanide, stretched and snapped back. It's not quite what Cyanide had in mind for the rest of her life. Sitting around being useless. So she goes to find Inan one day, as the Klaasu crew is outfitting the ship for another raiding run.
No, he says, staring at her like she's insane. You are not being a pirate when you just had a baby.
I had the baby 2 years ago. She can only change so many diapers, pester people for lessons in Eterpic so often, and help with the net fishing so many times before she goes mad. She's done with nursing, which is the excuse Inan's used up to now to put her off, and which was pointless anyway, since in Maeve,
That sort of thing is done communally, same as everything else. When she's not around, Alabaster just takes the baby to one of the other mothers in the calm, just as Cyan fed their babies in turn if they happened to be hungry while she was nearby and full of milk. And since Baster does most of the diaper changes and sings little Corundum to sleep and coos at him and plays with him and takes him for walks and so on, Cyanite has to keep busy somehow.
Cyanite.
He stops in the middle of the loading ramp that leads into the ship's hold. They're putting storage barrels of water and food aboard, along with baskets of more esoteric things, buckets of chain for the catapult, bladders of pitch and fish oil, a length of heavy cloth, meant to serve as a replacement sail should they require it. When Inan stops with Cyanite standing down ramp from him, everything else stops, and when there are loud complaints from the dock, he lifts his head and glowers until everyone shuts up. Everyone, of course, except Cyanite. I'm bored, she says in frustration. There's nothing to do here except fish and wait for you and the others to come back from a raid and gossip about people I don't know and tell stories about things I don't care about. I've spent my whole life either training or working for Earth's sake. You can't expect me to just sit around and look at water all day.
Alabaster does.
Cyanite rolls her eyes, although this is true. When Alabaster isn't with the baby, he spends most of his days up on the heights above the colony, gazing out at the world and thinking unfathomable thoughts for hours on end. She knows. She's watched him do it.
I'm not him. Inan, you can use me.
And Inan's expression twists because... Yes. That one hits home for him. It's an unspoken thing between them. But Cyanite's not stupid. There are a lot of things a skilled Raga can do to help on the kinds of sorties Inan's crew makes. Not starting shakes or blows. She won't, and he'd never ask it. But it is a simple thing to draw enough strength from the ambient to lower the temperature at the water's surface, and thus cloak the ship in fog to hide its approach or retreat. It is equally easy to disturb forests along the shoreline with the most delicate of underground vibrations, causing flocks of birds or hordes of mice to flood out of the trees and into nearby settlements as a distraction. And more. Orogeny is damned useful, Cyanite is beginning to understand, for far, far more than just quelling shakes. Or rather, it could be useful. If Inan could use his orogeny that way. Yet for all his awesome charisma and physical prowess, Inan is still a feral, with nothing more than what little training Harless, himself a feral and poorly trained, could give him. She's felt Inan's orogeny when he quells local minor shakes, and the crude inefficiency of his power shocks her sometimes. She's tried to teach him better control, and he listens and he tries. But he doesn't improve. She doesn't understand why. Without that level of skill, the Klausu crew earns its spoils the old-fashioned way. They fight and die for every scrap.
Alabaster can do these things for us,
Inan says, looking uneasy.
Alabaster? Cyan says, trying for patience. Get sick just looking at this thing.
She gestures at Klausu's curving bulk. The joke all over the calm is that Baster somehow manages to look green despite his blackness whenever he's forced aboard a ship. Cyan threw up less when she had morning sickness.
What if I don't do anything but cloak the ship?
Or whatever you order me to do. Inan puts his hands on his hips, his expression derisive.
You pretend that you will follow my orders. You don't even do that in bed.
Oh, you bastard. Now he's just being an ass, because he doesn't actually try to give her orders in bed. It's just a weird Meovite thing to tease about sex. Now that Cyan can understand what everyone's saying,
Every other statement seems to be about her sharing her bedtime with two of the best-looking men in the calm. Inan says they only do this to her because she turns such interesting colors when little old ladies make vulgar jokes about positions and rope knots. She's trying to get used to it. That's completely irrelevant.
Is it?
He pokes her in the chest with a big finger.
No lovers on ship. That is the rule I have always followed. We cannot even be friends once we set sail. What I say goes. Anything else and we die. You question everything, Cyanide. And there is no time for questioning on the sea.
That's not an unfair point. Cyan shifts uneasily. I can follow orders without question. Earth knows I've done enough of that. Inan, she takes a deep breath. Earth's sake, Inan. I'll do anything to get off this island for a while.
And that is another problem.
He steps closer and lowers his voice.
Corondum is your son, Cyanide. Do you feel nothing for him, but you constantly chafe to be away?
I make sure he's taken care of. And she does. Corundum is always clean and well-fed. She never wanted a child. But now that she's had it, him, and held him and nursed him and all that, she does feel a sense of accomplishment, maybe. And rueful acknowledgement, because she and Alabaster have managed to make one beautiful child between them. She looks into her son's face sometimes and marvels that he exists, that he seems so whole and right, when both his parents have nothing but bitter brokenness between them. Who's she kidding? It's love. She loves her son. But that doesn't mean she wants to spend every hour of every rusting day in his presence. Inan shakes his head and turns away, throwing up his hands.
Fine. Fine, fine, ridiculous woman. Then you go and tell Alabaster we will both be away.
All right. But he's gone up the ramp and into the hold, where she hears him yelling at someone else about something that she can't quite catch, because her ears can't parse Eterpic when it echoes at that volume. Regardless, she bounces a little as she heads down the ramp, waving in vague apology to the other crew members, who are standing around looking mildly annoyed. Then she heads into the calm. Alabaster's not in the house, and Corundum's not with Celsi, the woman who most often keeps the smaller children of the colony when their parents are busy. Celsi raises her eyebrows at Cyan when she pokes her head in.
He said yes?
Me said yes. Cyanite can't help grinning, and Celsi laughs.
Then we will never see you again, I wager.
Waves wait only for the nets. Which Cyanite guesses is some sort of Mayov proverb, whatever it means.
Alabaster is on the heights with Koru again.
Again. Thanks, she says, and shakes her head. It's a wonder their child doesn't sprout wings. She heads up the steps to the topmost level of the island, and over the first rise of rock. And there they are, sitting on a blanket near the cliff. Koru looks up as she approaches, beaming and pointing at her. Alabaster, who probably felt her footsteps on the stair, doesn't bother turning. Inan's finally taking you with him, he asks when Cyan gets close enough to hear his soft voice. Huh. Cyanite settles on the blanket beside him and opens her arms for Koru, who clambers out of Alabaster's lap, where he's been sitting, and into Cyanite's. If I'd known you already knew, I wouldn't have bothered walking up all those steps.
It was a guess.
You don't usually come up here with a smile on your face.
I knew it had to be something.
Alabaster turns at last, watching Koru as he stands in her lap and pushes at her breasts. Cyanite holds him reflexively, but he's actually doing a good job of keeping his balance, despite the unevenness of her lap. Then Cyanite notices that it's not just Corundum that Alabaster is watching.
What?
she asks, frowning.
Will you come back?
And that, completely out of the blue as it is, makes Cyanite drop her hands. Fortunately, Koru's got the trick of standing on her legs, which she does, giggling, while she stares at Alabaster.
Why are you even... What?
Alabaster shrugs, and it's only then that Cyanite notices the furrow between his brows and the haunted look in his eyes, and it's only then that she understands what Inan was trying to say to her. As if to reinforce this, Alabaster says bitterly,
You don't have to be with me anymore. You have your freedom, like you wanted. And Inan's got what he wanted. A Raga child to take care of the calm if something happens to him. He's even got me to train the child better than Harless ever could, because he knows I won't leave.
Fire under earth! Cyanite sighs and pushes away Koru's hands, which hurt. No, little greedy child, I don't have milk anymore. Settle down. And because this immediately makes Koru's face screw up with thwarted sorrow, she pulls him close and wraps her arms around him and starts playing with his feet, which is usually a good way to distract him before he gets going. It works. Apparently small children are inordinately fascinated by their own toes. Who knew? And with that child taken care of, she can focus on Alabaster, who's now looking out to sea again, but who's probably just as close to a meltdown.
You could leave, she says, pointing out the obvious, because that's what she always has to do with him.
Inan's offered before to take us back to the mainland if we want to go. If we don't do anything stupid, like still a shake in front of a crowd of people, either of us could probably make a decent life somewhere.
We have a decent life here.
It's hard to hear him over the wind, and yet she can actually feel what he's not saying. Don't leave me.
Crusty Rust! Faster! What is wrong with you? I'm not planning to leave.
Not now, anyway. But it's bad enough that they're having this conversation at all. She doesn't need to make it worse.
I'm just going somewhere I can be useful.
You're useful here!
And now he turns to glare at her full on. And it actually bothers her, the hurt and loneliness that lurk beneath the veneer of anger on his face. It bothers her. More than this bothers her.
No, I'm not.
And when he opens his mouth to protest, she runs over him.
I'm not. You said it yourself.
Mayov has a 10-ringer now to protect it.
Don't think I haven't noticed how we haven't had so much as a subsurface twitch in my range. Not in all the time we've been here.
You've been quelling any possible threat long before Inan or I can feel it. But then she trails off, frowning. Because Alabaster is shaking his head, and there's a smile on his lips that makes her abruptly uneasy.
Not me, he says.
What?
I haven't quelled anything for about a year now.
And then he nods toward the child, who is now examining Cyanite's fingers with intent concentration. She stares down at Koru, and Koru looks up at her and grins. Corundum is exactly what the Fulcrum hoped for when they paired her with Alabaster. He hasn't inherited much of Alabaster's looks, being only a shade browner than Cyan, and with hair that's already growing from fuzz into the beginnings of a proper ashblow bottle brush. She's the one with Sun-Zed ancestors, so that didn't come from Baster either. But what Koru does have from his father is an almighty powerful awareness of the earth. It has never occurred to Cyanite before now that her baby might be aware enough to sess and still micro-shakes. That's not instinct. That's skill. Evil earth? She murmurs. Koru giggles. Then Alabaster abruptly reaches over and plucks him out of her arms, getting to his feet.
Wait, this...
Go, he snaps, grabbing the basket he's brought up with them and crouching to dump baby toys and a folded diaper back into it.
Ride your rusting boat. Get yourself killed along with Inn, and what do I care? I will be here for Koru, no matter what you do.
And then he's gone, his shoulders tight and his walk brisk, ignoring Koru's shrill protest, and not even bothering to take the blanket that Sion's still sitting on. Earth fires.
Sionite stays topside a while, trying to figure out how she ended up becoming the emotional caretaker for a crazy ten-ringer, while stuck out in the middle of rusting nowhere with his inhumanly powerful baby. Then the sun sets, and she gets tired of thinking about it. So she gets up and grabs the blanket and heads back down to the comm. Everyone's gathering for the evening meal, but Sionite begs off being social this time, just grabbing a plate of roasted tule fish and braised three-leaf with sweetened barley that must have been stolen from some mainland calm. She carries this back to the house, and is unsurprised to find Alabaster there already, curled up in the bed with a sleeping Koru. They've upgraded to a bigger bed for Inan's sake. This mattress, suspended from four sturdy posts by a kind of hammock-like net that is surprisingly comfortable and durable, despite the weight and activity they put on it. Alabaster's quiet but awake when Sion comes in, so she sighs and scoops up Koru and puts him to bed in the nearby smaller suspended bed, which is lower to the ground in case he rolls or climbs out in the night. Then she climbs into bed with Alabaster, just looking at him. And after a while, he gives up the distant treatment and edges a little closer. He doesn't meet her eyes as he does this, but Sionite knows what he needs, so she sighs and rolls onto her back, and he edges closer still, finally resting his head on her shoulder, where he's probably wanted to be all along.
"Sorry," he says.
Sionite shrugs. "Don't worry about it." And then, because Inan's right, and this is partly her fault, she sighs and adds, "I'm coming back. I do like it here, you know. I just get restless."
"You're always restless. What are you looking for?"
She shakes her head.
"I don't know."
But she thinks, almost but not quite subconsciously, a way to change things. Because this is not right.
He's always good at guessing her thoughts. "You can't make anything better," he says heavily. "The world is what it is. Unless you destroy it and start all over again, there's no changing it."
He sighs, rubs his face against her breast.
"Take what you can get out of it, Sion. Love your son. Even live the pirate life if that makes you happy. But stop looking for anything better than this."
She licks her lips. "Corundum should have better." Alabaster sighs.
"Yes, he should."
He says nothing more, but the unspoken is palpable.
"He won't, though."
"It isn't right." She drifts off to sleep. And a few hours later, she wakes up. Because Alabaster is blurting, "Oh, fuck. Oh, please. Oh, Earth. I can't. Inan." Against Inan's shoulder, and jerking in a way that disturbs the bed's gentle sway, while Inan pants and ruts against him, cock on oily cock. And then because Alabaster is spent, but Inan isn't, and Inan notices her watching, he grins at her and kisses Alabaster, and then slides a hand between Sion's legs. Of course, she's wet. He and Alabaster are always beautiful together. Inan is a considerate lover, so he leans over and nuzzles her breasts and does marvelous things with his fingers and does not stop thrusting against Alabaster until she curses and demands all of his attention for a while, which makes him laugh and shift over. Alabaster watches while Inan obliges her, and his gaze grows hot with it,
which Cyanite still doesn't understand, even after being with them for almost 2 years. Pastor doesn't want her, not that way, nor she him. And yet it's unbelievably arousing for her to watch in and drive him to moaning and begging. And Alabaster also clearly gets off on her going to pieces with someone else. She likes it more when Baster's watching, in fact. They can't stand sex with each other directly, but vicariously it's amazing. And what do they even call this? It's not a threesome or a love triangle. It's a two-and-a-half-some, an affection dihedron, and, well, maybe it's love. She should worry about another pregnancy, maybe from Alabaster again, given how messy things get between the three of them. But she can't bring herself to worry, because it doesn't matter. Someone will love her children no matter what. Just as she doesn't think over much about what she does with her bedtime or how this thing between them works, no one in Mayov will care no matter what. That's another turn-on, probably. The utter lack of fear. Imagine that. So they fall asleep, Inan snoring on his belly between them, and Baster and Cyan with their heads pillowed on his big shoulders, and not for the first time does Cyanide think, if only this could last. She knows better than to wish for something so impossible. The Klaalsu sets sail the next day. Alabaster stands out on the pier with half the rest of the calm that is waving and well-wishing. He doesn't wave, but he does point to them as the ship pulls away, encouraging Koru to wave when Cyanite and Inan do. Koru does it, and for a moment, Cyanite feels something like regret. It passes quickly. Then there is only the open sea and work to be done, casting lines for fish and climbing high up into the masts to do things to the sails when Inan tells them to, and at one point securing several barrels that have come loose down in the hold. It's hard work, and Cyanite falls asleep in her little bunk under one of the bulkheads not long after sunset, because Inan won't let her sleep with him, and, anyway, she doesn't have the energy to make it up to his cabin. But it gets better, and she gets stronger as the days pass, beginning to see why the Klaalsu crew have always seemed a little more vibrant, a little more interesting than everyone else in Mayov. On the fourth day out, there's a call from the left. Rust from the port side of the ship, and she and the others come to the railing to see something amazing. The curling plumes of ocean spray where great monsters of the deep have risen to swim alongside them. One of them breaches the surface to look at them, and it's ridiculously huge. Its eye is bigger than Cyan's head. One slap of its fins could capsize the ship, but it doesn't hurt them, and one of the crew members tells her that it's just curious. She seems amused by Cyanite's awe. At night, they look at the stars. Cyan has never paid much attention to the sky. The ground beneath her feet was always more important. But Inan points out patterns in the ways that the stars move and explains that the stars she sees are actually other suns with other worlds of their own and perhaps other people living other lives and facing other struggles. She has heard of pseudosciences like astronomistry, knows that its adherents make unprovable claims like this. But now, looking at the constantly moving sky, she understands why they believe it. She understands why they care. When the sky is so immutable and irrelevant to most of daily life, on nights like these, for a little while, she cares too. Also at night, the crew drinks and sings songs. Cyanite mispronounces vulgar words, inadvertently making them more vulgar, and makes instant friends of half the crew by doing so. The other half of the crew reserves judgment until they spy a likely target on the seventh day.
They've been lurking near the shipping lanes between two heavily populated peninsulas, and people up in the mast nest have been watching with spyglasses for ships worth the effort of robbing. Inan doesn't give the order until the lookout tells them he's spotted an especially large vessel of the sort often used to ferry trade goods too heavy or dangerous for easy overland carting. Oils and quarried stone and volatile chemicals and timber. The very sorts of things that a calm stuck on a barren island in the middle of nowhere might need most. This one's accompanied by another vessel, which is smaller, and which, according to those who see it through the spyglass and can tell such things by sight, is probably bristling with militia soldiers, battering rams, and armaments of its own. Maybe one's a carrack, and the other's a caravel. Those are the words the sailors use. But she can't remember which one's which, and it's a pain in the ass to try, so she's going to stick with the big boat and the small boat. Their readiness to fight off pirates confirms that the freighter carries something worth pirating. Inan looks at Cyanide, and she grins fiercely. She raises two fogs. The first requires her to pull ambient energy from the farthest edge of her range, but she does it, because that's where the smaller ship is. The second fog she raises in a corridor between Klaalsu and the cargo vessel, so that they will be on their target almost before it sees them coming. It goes like clockwork. Inan's crew are mostly experienced and highly skilled. The ones like Cyanide, who don't know what they're doing yet, are pushed to the periphery, while the others set to. The Klaalsu comes out of the fog, and the other vessel starts ringing bells to sound the alarm, but it's too late. Inan's people fire the catapults and shred their sails with baskets of chain. Then the Klaalsu sidles up close. Cyan thinks they're going to hit, but Inan knows what he's doing. And others in the crew throw hooks across the gap between them, hitching the ships together and then winching them closer with the big crankworks that occupy much of the deck. It's dangerous at this point, and one of the older members of the crew shoes Cyan below decks when people on the cargo ship start firing arrows and slingstones and throwing knives at them. She sits in the shadow of the steps while the other crew members run up and down them, and her heart is pounding, her palms are damp. Something heavy thuds into the hull, not 5 feet from her head, and she flinches. But evil Earth, this is so much better than sitting around on the island, fishing and singing lullabies. It's over in minutes. When the commotion dies down and Cyanide dares to venture up on top again, she sees that planks have been run between the two vessels, and Inan's people are running back and forth along them. Some of them have captured members of the cargo vessel's crew and corralled them on deck, holding them at glass knife point. The rest of the crew is surrendering, giving up weapons and valuables for fear the hostages will be hurt. Already some of Inan's sailors are going into the holds, bringing up barrels and crates and carting them across to the Klaalsu's deck. They'll sort out the booty later. Speed is of the essence now. But all at once there are shouts, and someone in the rigging hits a bell frantically. And out of the roiling fog looms the attack ship that accompanied the cargo vessel. It's on them, and belatedly Cyanide realizes her error. She had assumed that the attack ship would stop, given that it couldn't see, knowing itself in proximity to other vessels. People are not that logical. Now the attack ship is coming at full speed, and even though she can hear cries of alarm from its decks as they also realize the danger, there's no way it will be able to stop before it rams into Klaalsu and the cargo ship, and probably sinks all three. Cyanide is brimming with power, drawn from the warmth and boundless waves of the sea. She reacts, as she has been taught in 100 fulcrum drills without thinking. Down, through the strange slipperiness of seawater minerals, through the soggy uselessness of the ocean sediment, down. There is stone beneath the ocean, and it is old and raw, and hers to command. In another place, she claws up with her hands and shouts and thinks, "Up!" And suddenly the attack ship cracks loudly and jerks to a halt. People stop screaming, shocked into silence, on all three vessels. This is because suddenly there is a massive, jagged knife of bedrock jutting several feet above the attack ship's deck, skewering the vessel from the keel up. Shaking, Cyanite lowers her hands slowly. The cries aboard the Klaus-Su turn from alarm into ragged cheers. Even a few of the cargo vessel's people look relieved. One ship damaged is better than three ships sunk. Things go quickly after that, with the attack ship helpless and skewered as it is. Inan comes to find her, just as the crew reports that the cargo ship's hold is empty. Cyan has moved to the bow, where she can see people on the attack ship's deck trying to chisel at the pillar. Inan stops beside her, and she looks up, braced for his anger. But he is far from angry.
"I did not know one could do such things," he says wonderingly. "I thought you and Alabaster were only boasting."
It is the first time Cyanite has been praised for her orogeny by someone not of the Fulcrum. And if she had not already begun to love Inan, she would now. "I shouldn't have brought it up so high," she says sheepishly. "If I'd thought first, I would have raised the column only enough to breach the hull so they'd think they ran over an obstacle." Inan sobers as he understands.
"Ah. And now they know. We have an origin of some skill aboard."
His expression hardens in a way that Cyanite does not understand, but she decides not to question it. It feels so good to stand here with him, basking in the glow of success. For a while, they just watch the cargo vessels unloading together. Then one of Inan's crewmen runs up to say they're done. The planks have been withdrawn, the ropes and hooks rolled back onto their crank wheels. They're ready to go. Inan says in a heavy voice,
"Hold!"
She almost knows what is coming then. But it still makes her feel ill. When he looks at Cyanite, his expression, ice.
"Sink them both."
She has promised never to question Inan's orders. Even so, she hesitates. She has never killed anyone before, not deliberately. It was just a mistake that she brought the stone projection up so high. Is it really necessary that people die for her folly? He steps close, and she flinches preemptively, even though he has never harmed her. Her hand bones twinge regardless. But Inan only says into her ear,
"For Bastur and Koru."
That makes no sense. Bastur and Koru are not here. But then the full implication of his words, that the safety of everyone in Meov depends on the mainlanders seeing them as a nuisance rather than a serious threat, sinks in. And makes her cold, too. Colder. So she says, "You should move us away." Inan turns at once and gives the order for the Klaus-Su to set sail. Once they have drifted to a safe distance, Cyanite takes a deep breath. For her family. It is strange thinking of them as such, for that is what they are. Stranger still to do something like this for a real reason, and not simply because she has been commanded to. Does that mean she is no longer a weapon? What does that make her then, if not? Doesn't matter. At a flick of her will, the bedrock column extracts itself from the attack ship's hull, leaving a 10-foot hole near the stern. It begins sinking immediately, tipping upward as it takes on water. Then, dragging more strength from the ocean's surface and raising fog enough to obscure sight for miles, Cyanite shifts the column to aim at the cargo vessel's keel. A quick thrust up, a quicker withdrawal. Like stabbing someone to death with a poniard. The ship's hull cracks like an egg, and after a moment splits into two halves. It's done. The fog completely obscures both sinking ships as the Klaus Su sails away. The two crews' screams fall.